Today's episode is powered by TD Ameritrade. Every stroke counts on the scorecard and every penny counts in the market. That's why TD Ameritrade is committed to straightforward pricing with no surprises, so you're free to swing with confidence. Visit tdameritrade.com/friedegg. Member SIPC. Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today I'm joined by Golf Channel personality, senior writer at Golf Week, and JeffShackelford.com owner, Jeff Shackelford. In part one of this two-part podcast, Jeff and I discuss the Masters, the youth invasion on tour, technology in golf, and much more. Part two will air later this week and focus on Jeff and Gil Hance's design of Rustic Canyon, golf architecture, photography, maintenance, and much more. Enjoy, and without further ado, here's Jeff Shackelford.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Impressions from Augusta this year. I saw you wrote something about the green speeds, and I think it was thoughtful. The pace of play was better, but a little fire was gone.
Well, there's not really been fire in the golf course for a long time, if you want to include the, well, just for me, fire is firm and fast throughout and dry. And obviously, the greens are generally fast, but the fairways haven't been fast in a long time since they've been doing the cut towards the tees. It really does work. It stops the roll. And by the way, for all those who would like to blame the agronomy for the ball going longer, you can look at the driving distance averages at Augusta and see what numbers look like without roll. But the greens were definitely slower. Of course, you know, a few people said, well, that was that because of the Anwan? I'm no, they were still very quick for the Anwan. They're still very quick greens. They're just not 13 and a half and 14. And the difference in the pace of play was noticeable. I believe on Thursday on Friday, it was, I think it was about 4.5, 4:35 for threesomes, which is amazing. And it's been almost an hour longer sometimes when there's wind.
It's, when J.B. Holmes gets around in 5 hours, something's going good.
Yeah. And you're out there and it is noticeable as a spectator too. It's funny too. And I wrote about this after the, Augusta National Women's Amateur that people thought the pace there was quick and it really wasn't. It was 4:20 for 30, players in twosomes to get around. But when you were out there, it didn't feel slow. That you felt like they were playing ready golf. And I attributed it mostly to the nice quick walks from green to the next tee shot. You just didn't spend a lot of time waiting for the players to go back there. But otherwise they were not anything special in terms of pace. So I thought it played better because of that. I mean, obviously, I think the course would be a lot more interesting if the ball were running and running into the trees, and the guys would actually, and it would favor somebody like Tiger even more in a funny way. I think he likes it playing faster, but he has adapted to what they do, and it was a beautiful thing to watch.
Yeah, they've obviously with the first cut, and if they widen the fairways and mowed out the width of the green, it would essentially make the fairways about the same width. And then instead of,
I think it'd make them narrower. If you took away the cut toward the tee, I think the speed of the ball rolling would make them play narrower. That's what's ironic about it.
Yeah.
Even in a year like this where it was soft.
And it's getting rid of the first cut and then the ball just runs right into the trees and the pine straw.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's always, and that's been an issue since they installed that. And then now that they've gotten really into this cut towards the tee, and it's a long grain. You know, it's not a tight fairway. Torrey Pines, who else overseeds that I've seen this year? I mean, Torrey's fairways are way better than Augusta's. It's not even close because it's just a tight cut. There's no grain, and it's a thick ryegrass overseed, and they're beautiful.
And Innisbrook overseeds, right?
Yes, they do. And then obviously TPC Sawgrass's fairways were incredible this year too. So, but if Augusta actually just had the normal cut and didn't do that, and it's a grainy, leafy cut, it's really weird. But it works. It just stops the ball, but it also stops it from rolling into trouble. So it works though, because 15 would, I think they, a few guys would actually get their drives down to the bottom of the hill if they had any helping wind at all.
One of the things I've looked into a lot is variance data with the majors, and you see what happens when it's rainy and when it's soft. The standard deviation set of players, so like scoring, gets very compressed. So, you know, if you think back to recent major championships, the courses that have had the most compressed scoring have been the wettest ones, like Baltusrol in 2016. Mm-hmm. Bellerive last year was one. But, you know, this year's Masters, when I saw the weather forecast, I said, hey, you know, this is going to be very compressed scoring. But, you know, one of the byproducts of that compressed scoring was we saw this leaderboard where, you know, heading into the back nine of Sunday, there was about 12 guys that could win. Do you think those bunch leaderboards is better for tournament golf, or do you like to see the separate... the guys separate and lift like you see it, you know, more firm and fast setups like, say, your Open Championships?
Yeah, I like the separation, obviously, because you feel like the best player usually is highlighted in that kind of a structure. But it's hard to complain about a leaderboard like we had at Augusta. And that golf course is generally one where it has been tough to separate yourself until the very end, and that's what makes it exciting. But yeah, I tend to think it's a better reflection on the architecture and the setup when you see that nice variance in the scoring and you see that separation. But and then we saw that in the women's amateur, and it should have happened there because those two players were clearly on a different level than some of the other players. Not that the other ones didn't perform pretty admirably, but they were clearly, all aspects of their game were just a little bit better if you watch them. And it's just been tougher and tougher for that to happen in tournaments, even with good setups. I mean, Carnoustie was baked out last year, and that was a tough one for somebody to separate themselves, in part because obviously they're just more people with more brain power behind them and making probably fewer mistakes in their preparation. And then obviously they all have really outstanding equipment, and maybe equipment that you could argue also makes it a little bit tougher for the superior ball striker to separate themselves. Tiger's now made that case twice with the driver, which I think is very interesting.
Yeah. It's I was going to say his comments are to that point where a lot of the skill has been, you know, removed. And you look at this youth invasion and you've got guys that are, you know, more so than ever 20 years old and contending on the PGA Tour. When you look at Tiger and guys like Justin Leonard, the great players, great AMs of yesteryear, and they were struggling to make cuts when they first were coming out.
And it's a tough point for a player like him to make. Adam Scott has very strong feelings about it. Now Phil has strong feelings about this. They don't want to sound like they're putting down younger players, and they don't want to be rude. But they've been around the game long enough to know when they're playing with somebody who swings a certain way and strikes the ball a certain way, that if you reduce the size of their driver head just a little bit, they would be a different player. And And it's been a fascinating thing to see that come out of the mouths of these guys in the last 5 years or so. Tiger does it very well. He does it in a way that's that beautiful kind of, you sit there and you listen, and then you go back and you read the transcript and you read between the lines, and it's so obvious what he's saying, but he's doing it in an artful way. And I'm starting to wonder, though, too. I'm suspicious of the fact that he's brought it up specifically with regards to driver head size. I'm starting to wonder if that is going to be the angle of attack from the governing bodies instead of the ball. I don't know, but I'm always watching those things and fascinated by those comments. And TaylorMade just came out with a modern club with all their bells and whistles and injections and twisting faces.
Screw faces.
But a 275 cc head. So, you know, I don't know if it's the right one to test, but it would be interesting. It's basically a two wood. I think it has a little too much loft to really test adequately. But I don't know. Maybe not. But I think it's fascinating that they've done that as well.
I messed around this winter on a TrackMan. I brought my modern driver Pro V1s straight out of the box professionals, and then a Persimmon driver and a Hickory driver. And what I saw was with the modern driver, modern ball, like you just, there's no foul balls. Like, you know, when you almost whiff the ball, it still goes, you know, the same distance. Right. And what I started to see was if I did it on the TrackMan, and, you know, your dispersion distance and direction was very consistent, modern. And then what I started to see was a angled dispersion with distance and direction, where I had the short right miss and the low left miss, right?
Right.
So all my misses that were left went pretty far, but all my misses right, you know, it brought back into play like that true foul ball.
Mm.
Because I think it was because of the head size. And that's what when I played high school golf, I always remember being afraid of that foul ball when, you know, I was in high school playing a smaller head, you know?
And I think that's where Tiger and Adam and Phil Mickelson are coming from too. They're just old enough to remember that fear factor of once you hit one of those quackers, that it makes it, tough to really let it go. And now Tiger and Phil are old enough to remember it with a small head and even Persimmon. Adam's probably more of that generation that remembers it from a small metal head with the early graphite shafts that were a little unpredictable. I mean, I remember sometimes you would swear you just put a great swing on the ball and it just the shaft just didn't react right. And you don't have that now. The stuff is so well made and so good, and if it's not, it gets replaced quickly and easily. And so that, you know, mentally, I saw Spieth hit an old style duck hook this year at Riviera. I mean, just a real goes out and darts left low, and I thought, and I told a few people, I have not seen one of those at a tour event in years. And you know, once you've hit one of those, it's almost the equivalent of a shank to a good player.
Yeah, the next two drives are probably going right.
Yeah, and they're tentative, and they're probably 10, 15 yards shorter because you're just trying to get it out there and not repeat that jarring, awful thing.
One of the byproducts of so we're seeing it right now is, to a certain extent, everybody celebrates this parity we're in, where any week we've got 30 guys that are winning. But when I think about long term, I mean, the most compelling storylines we have in golf are Tiger's, you know, quest for Jack's record, his win total, Phil's quest for the Grand Slam, and, you know, his longevity and, you know, adding to his career. And then you got Rory with the Grand Slam, and to a lesser extent, Jordan. But with this parity that everybody seems to be celebrating, are we missing the really true big stories?
I don't know if we're missing them. I don't get the celebration of it for the reasons you just highlighted, that we tend to like superstars and amazing stories and history. And I think it's more of a marketing driven approach to the game, because parity is good in that, you know, when you have so many events and you can still say, well, we have these top stars there, and there's, so there's some of that. And then obviously I don't like the parity, cause I think it's interesting when elite players are able to separate themselves. And I do wonder at times if the equipment makes it a little bit harder to do. Obviously there are other factors that aren't equipment related. So I am fascinated by that approach, but I ironically, I think this year's been one where you kind of start to have to wonder about the parity a little bit. It was the last few years going into the Masters, we've had this wealth of riches of star names who you could all make a case for going in, and this year you really couldn't. It was a small group, or a smaller group, that you'd say, wow, well, he's just been great every week. And he's gonna have a great week there too, barring a bad tee time or something like that. So, I'm not as big of a fan of it, but I understand it. It's a great narrative. It just sounds great. We've never seen a generation like this. We've never seen field depth, and you've probably seen me taking that on a little bit more. Not because I'm anti-millennial. I'm really getting tired of it, and I'm starting to get, frankly, kind of angry about it, but I'm anti rushing people into a career in golf and telling them they're ready and it's time and you can go out and win right now on the PGA Tour because you won the Southwestern Intercollegiate and you know, the average age winner this year on the tour is over 33 and over 34 since the beginning of the year when we've had the best fields. And there's a really long list now of the next great thing that was told, yeah, you don't need to go to college for the last 3 months. You need to get out there now. You're ready. And it's not pretty. It's not right. And it's I think the reasons for it are again, driven by marketing. We've got to make this tour younger. We've got to make these players younger. And then there's, of course, a whole group of people around these people looking to make some money off them too, which is not great either.
Yeah, it's so telling when you go, and I know you covered last year's USAM, you've covered, mm-hmm. you covered the Walker Cup, and you've covered, you know, some collegiate stuff. It's so telling when you get out there and you're following these guys, and there's just, you can see the army of agents and equipment reps. You know, amateurs.
That's the gallery at the U.S. Amateur now.
Yeah, it's just
and they get right up on the tee and you know, good shot. And you're like, hey, dude, you're from a company. Like, go down the fairway and be subtle about this. My gosh, he's still an amateur, but nah, it doesn't even. It's just they've just thrown all that out the window.
It's crazy because, like, you know, I even think about it, it's like college programs with their sponsorships. You know, they're a very loose amateur term as of now. And I think in general, we see it across all sports, the amateurism, you know, what a true amateur is kind of changing.
Oh, it's gone. Yeah, it's gone. And I struggle with making the case because as a society, we're so eager to rush people into adulthood and rush them into cashing in now. And it's not been good for any sport that's done it. I mean, I've been fascinated of late how many people are down on the NBA right now after taking this incredible ride and how many times it's the quality of the play that is starting to really be noticeable to people, and you have to attribute that to sort of the breakdown in the system of going to college and playing college basketball and developing, and then even people who saw that coming, like Charles Barkley and Shaq, now even they back off that and say, yeah, you can't deny somebody the right. If somebody wants to write them a check at 18, you know, that's capitalism. It's like, well, wait a second. You know, the quality of your sport is diminished. You can't back off that point. And now I think we're, you know, golf is a little different in that it's not a team sport. You don't sign a team contract. And man, it is a cruel thing to throw somebody out there, cash in on them, and then after about a year, if you haven't done anything, people move on to the next thing. And we know it's a sport that it takes some time to get the seasoning and get used to the travel. And I mean, I just happened to look at some names on the web.com money list the other day just to see how they were doing. And I was just astounded at some of the next great talents that aren't doing a whole lot out there right now. And I just cringed because it was like, gosh, and you know, they were in a hurry to leave college. And there are only a few people who are probably held back by college golf who are just unique talents who are just ready to go. And the rest, it's a great thing to play college golf for 4 years and have somebody else paying for your travel and experiencing that and getting a little bit older and just getting more mature.
Now let's take a quick break to talk a little bit about our sponsor. Today's episode is powered by TD Ameritrade. Whether on the course or in the market, it helps to have a second set of eyes to keep you on your game. That's why TD Ameritrade's trade desk is here to help gut check your strategies so you always feel confident teeing up a trade. Visit tdameritrade.com/friedegg to learn more about what their trade desk can do for you. Member SIPC. Now back to Jeff Shackelford.
Yeah, that's the thing with golf is, I think the hardest, one of the biggest things that these guys have to adjust to is being a professional.
Sure.
And you see, like Norman Jung, who's one of
the
guys.
Well, that
was
one of the names that I did notice, yes.
He made his first cut. You know, he's a 19-year-old trying to live on his own on the web.com. It's got to be a very, very tough transition, you imagine. And you feel for a kid like that to a certain extent. And he's got a great story with his upbringing. And, you know, he's definitely not your like cookie cutter pro. And I think there's a lot of reasons for him turning pro. He can do a lot for his family, but it's just a very difficult situation to be thrown into at 19, because it's not like the minor leagues of baseball where you've got a team that's getting you around just like college golf, like who's paying for your meals and everything. Like you're out on your own. You eat what you kill. And I guess that's one of the beauties of golf, but also one of the challenges for, it kind of makes me think back to earlier in the year when the PGA Tour talked about, you know, the rumored exemptions to in creating a college program that, you know, rewards excellent amateur play to get them into PGA Tour events. And that seems to be where it's going.
I was very excited about the news of that, and I'm a little saddened by the way Jay Monahan took it out. It seemed like he just kind of killed it at the Players this year, or you know, he implied that it got out too early, it wasn't ready to be put out. Well, guess who put it out? The PGA Tour. So that to me was a disturbing thing, because I loved the concept of where they were trying to go, and it may have just been as simple as the NCAA went, are you out of your mind? This is, you can't do that. We don't associate with a professional sports league. But it seemed, at least in the few details that came out, that the concept was, we recognize that it is a smart thing for somebody to stay in college for 4 years and get a degree and travel and play great tournaments. I mean, look at some of the places where college golf is playing these days, and it's getting more coverage in media, so they're getting exposed to doing interviews and all that part of the lifestyle. And it's a good developmental tour, and it seemed like the PGA Tour was recognizing that it's good for them and kind of learning from what the NBA has not been able to do. And then he just killed it. So I hope it comes back, but it was really a strange one. And I don't have an answer as to why that was the case, but it would address a lot of the things you just were discussing with Norm Jean. Of course, he was touted as somebody who could, there was nothing else for him to do in college. I heard that a couple times, and like, well, he's 19.
Yeah, he was great last year, but then you look at a season like Matt Wolf's putting together and you're like, oh, well, that's like really great. what Matthew Wolf's doing, or like even Colin Morikawa. Colin Morikawa to me is like the perfect example of a kid that I expect he's really ready to turn professional, but it's, you know, as a freshman, he lost in a playoff in a web event. Like, yeah. How many of these kids would have turned pro right then?
Right. And by the way, he would be somebody who you actually would have really looked at and said, wow, he was so polished and impressive at the Walker Cup, as was Doug Gim, who, you know, is chugging along pretty nicely right now, I think. And I have, you know, even though he doesn't hit the ball a long way, you just feel like there's somebody who's really solid and knows how to score and knows how to live life and get through the things that we were kind of hitting on there. And so there is more to it than just being able to play. But yeah, Colin's one, and Victor Hovland's another person you look at and go, wow, he's pretty mature.
Yeah, and then you look at a guy like Will Zalatoris, a great player, but he just left school for I don't know why. You know, obviously with the way the tour schedule is structured, you get some advantages. But I saw last week was his first top 10 on the web. You know, and I don't think he has full status out there or any status.
Yeah, no, it's quite a list of people that you just think, why really you just didn't want to do 3 to 4 more months. And but I don't necessarily blame them. I think it's, as you say, you know, the people around them, you go to the U.S. Amateur and you see who's there and what they're telling them. And so that's kind of why I'm hitting on that point. I don't want to pick on the players. I don't want to pick on 19 and 20 year olds with big dreams and a lot of confidence and a lot of just loads of talent. I'm more annoyed at the adults in the room who are, doing what we hate seeing in other sports, and now it's coming to golf. And so I'm going to keep pointing it out.
Yeah. You look at like CT Pan's a perfect example. It takes a long time to win, and he was as decorated of an amateur player as you could find. Great, you know, highly regarded as a 16-year-old, and it takes a long time, especially if you don't seem to have like that dominant power. That's the guy that you're still going to see them make it up and really thrive when they're hitting into their late 20s versus, you know, the guys like Cam Champ can dominate right away because they're, you know, one of the best on tour at something.
Yeah. But then those, if they're out there long enough or they're around the game long enough, a CT Pan can kind of see his strengths and understand his weaknesses and understand how to make out a schedule and pick his battles and know how to really have a nice long career based on his strengths and not get caught up in what he doesn't do well. I think that's starting to be what's interesting about Jordan Spieth is I really, as great as he was, my sense is he sees where the game's going and he's tried to change to be part of this other way the game is played that's not who he is, and I think it's gotten him in a little bit of trouble, at least on the ball striking side and the way he approaches a course. And it's a bizarre thing to see, and it shocks people, but this is just how the sport is right now. You can get derailed pretty quickly if you try to be somebody you're not or play a game that you're not capable of playing.
Yeah. I think that's the thing with golf is everybody always looks at it. And I had Luke Donald on the podcast and he said one of the most damaging moments of his career. I think he answered what would you kind of go back? Like what moment would you go, do you reflect on a lot? And he said the final round when he played with Justin Rose at the U.S. Open at Marion. Because had he won, it would have been completely different. But because he fell short, he looked at Justin Rose and said, I need to play like that.
Mm.
And it's funny because if the opposite happens and Donald wins,
right,
Rose probably would have looked at Donald and said, I need to do that like Luke Donald does.
Yeah.
And that's just golf.
And we've heard that story, that narrative many times that somebody sees something and they just have to make a change and it almost never works for them, and Luke's name comes up a lot in that narrative because he was so good, so consistent, so rock solid, and just a money machine and contention machine. And I understand it though too. You know, you have to look at what's going on in the sport, and you do see what advantages people get playing the game a certain way, especially right now in this sort of bomb and gouge approach. And you can't blame them for noticing it and wanting to try to adapt a little bit.
So, you know, we got derailed here early on.
What a
down
shock.
Rabbit hole.
Early on.
getting back on course, this PGA, the new schedule, could anything have gone better for the PGA Championship than Tiger winning the Masters?
No, especially because it wasn't sold out. And they've now sold out the weekend, so that's good. But yeah, no, it's fantastic, especially at a place that he's had success at, and the crowds will just be, they'll be amped up for him, for Phil, they're just a lot of people who they're going to be excited about. It's just fantastic, especially because I think we've already are seeing a little bit of that, oversaturation of the New York market in the response to some of these events, and which a few of us warned with all these majors being awarded to that general area, that there might be a little bit of a fatigue factor. And so he's just put that out of its misery.
Yeah, with the U.S. Open last year, this, and then they've got a FedEx Cup stop. This, I mean, it's a lot of golf in there, and I don't think.
Yeah, we got Wingfoot. There's just a lot of tournaments in the area. Trump Bedminster. It just goes on and on. I think every year till 24, there's a major or a major cup event.
What would you say your thoughts on the new schedule are? You know, now that we're kind of in the thick of it, has anything changed?
I think so far, no. I think it's really good. The one issue or one thing I think we're finally going to see here a little bit, but not so far. They've done a very good job of getting nice fields, but I do think the Zurich was the first sign, and I think the AT&T at Trinity Forest will be the next sign that there are going to be regular tour events that really take a hit from this schedule, where it just the players just go, I know I have to play the RBC events or whatever their reason. I know I have to play AT&T because Mr. Stevenson's on our board and we need to be nice to him. You know, there is a point where they're just going to go, I can't play that much. I mean, as we're recording this, Tiger Woods still hasn't committed to Quail Hollow. And just watching a video of him limping into this shoot for Golf TV. So I'm not sure we'll even see him at Quail Hollow. But so I think that's where it's great for the majors. I mean, to think that we're going right now to a major championship after Augusta, it's pretty exciting to have that momentum. But I do wonder what it's going to do to. I mean, I think Tony Romo may be the second biggest draw at the. And he might be the biggest draw at the AT&T this year at Trinity Forest.
Yeah, Spieth might be like in the 40s at that time in the world rankings, which is I mean, if be one of the things that if you said 2 years ago Jordan Spieth would be the 38th ranked player, whatever he is right now. You know, that'd be one of the long shot bets of the century.
It would, but again, it's a fickle sport. You know, we've gotten spoiled, I think, by some of these players who've been pretty consistent for a while or at a young age, and we just have to remember that it just doesn't take much to throw you off a little bit, and he might have made a few mistakes, or he might be a little bit stubborn, or he might have been a little bit unlucky. I mean, it just doesn't take much to derail you. I mean, look at Patrick Reed, how hard he works at it, and it's not getting better. It's getting worse, and maybe. And So it's a cruel sport that way. But by the way, so Trinity Forest also, just to get to that topic, the other issue, obviously, with that one is not just the date and a busy schedule, but also I think there's a sense that the players, even though they tried so hard to make it palatable to the modern mindset, they still didn't like it. And so I think if you guys are just skipping it because it's not a good pre-PGA Championship course, which I think is a shame, but I understand the mentality that a Lynx-y style week before Bethpage isn't exactly a great preparation. But I don't know, that may be overrated too.
Yeah, I think that it doesn't make a ton of sense also to have the back-to-back Dallas weeks separated.
Yeah,
I mean, you talk about making it easy for guys to go places. That's a perfect example of making it very difficult and forcing people to choose who's going to go Dallas to Long Island back to Dallas. You know,
yeah,
it's just not going to happen. But you know, when somebody's planning their schedule, they see two Dallas stops in a row. It's like, well, that's pretty easy. You know, good city to go hang out in for 2 weeks.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely the one that stood out when they released the schedule that just didn't quite make sense and probably will be needing some adjustments, especially given AT&T's role in the sport and their influence and their possible interest in being a television partner as well.
Yeah, I would have loved to see, and I know this doesn't work because obviously FedEx paid the big bill, but if you were going to do something and give somebody a WGC, that would have been a place that I would have loved to see. And I know I had heard rumors that it might become the match play spot, but that just got re-upped down in Austin. So it's in a very precarious spot. And then I've also seen, following the superintendent Casey Koff on Twitter, they're having historic rain totals this year too. So
yeah, but he's still going to try to get it a little firmer and faster, from what I've heard, and what the owner wants. So, I mean, I love that place, so I hope it goes well.
Yeah, I think what we saw last year, and we saw from a lot of guys, was like they realized, like, wow, if I play great golf, I'm going to shoot a really good score, and any type of golfer out there can play great golf on the golf course and shoot a good score. It's, you know, it's a course that it just boggles my mind how, you know, these guys can go out to the Open Championship 1 week and talk about how amazing it is and how great of a golf experience it is, and then 2 weeks before that, they can throw a fit about the golf style there, which is, you know, essentially an American version of it.
Yeah, it was really strange. The caddies had an outing there, I think, the year before, and that really started a narrative that wasn't great. I don't know if the conditions were extreme that day. I don't remember what their thing was, but there, once you get them going on a narrative, that can be dangerous. And then, you know, there are no trees and it's there's no Four Seasons Hotel. The range is over. You have to take the shuttle, you know, all these weird little elements to it that they immediately start developing a viewpoint, and it just snowballs from there. And it's bizarre to watch. And it's why I thought the tour did a great job kind of easing them into that place, but we'll find out if it was enough to draw a good field back.
Something that you've been, from the beginning is the condensing of the LA Open, the men's LA Open. I guess it's LA Open no more. LA Invitational now.
Yeah, we're waiting to hear the new name. I don't know what it'll be.
But the, you know, smaller field size, and it goes into this, you know, beyond the majors, we now have these, we have the Players, which is its own, you know, quasi major, or they say it is. And then we have the WGCs, and, you know, what are your thoughts on this new elevated status tag that's getting thrown around?
Well, I understand it in the case of this event. You are locking in Tiger to be associated with it the rest of his life, essentially. But And then you hear the reasons, and obviously there are a lot of great reasons, but then there are also the pace of play reasons. And we just, you know, the days are so short at the one here in L.A. that it's just really hard to get a field around, especially at the pace they go at now. But field size, as we know, is not always the cause of pace of play. They like to say it is, but you get small fields that still take 5 hours and 30 minutes if the conditions are a certain way. So I have mixed feelings about it. I have very strong feelings about it in the case of the LA event, because it's been an open event since the beginning. And if you go back and read about it, there was a lot of pride in the fact that it was an open event. And through the 93 years there, there's some amazing stories because it was an open event and because there was a qualifying and people like Babe Zaharias qualified and played in the LA Open. So I love open events and I love what they do in a community. And I was talking to a golf pro yesterday about this very thing, and that, you know, the local section spot will probably go away. And, you know, about once every 4 to 5 years, that created a fantastic local story of a pro making the cut or a pro shooting 64 who's a club pro and that kind of thing. And I love those little elements to a golf tournament, and I think that's what you lose. But I just don't know how much people value that. I think they still do.
Yeah, I think the purists value it. I think that's the, you know, but the mass appeal is all about, you know, 10 guys. And I think that's something that Tiger's illuminating, is like how little it's almost like a blessing and a curse when he comes back. You know, he comes back and you realize, like, well, does anything really matter outside of the four majors?
In a way, and that's probably about right. That's kind of where I've been lately. I've been really major focused there's just so much in a short period that there is a point where you have to kind of pace yourself, whether you work covering it or whether you're a fan. And ultimately the majors are the things and the Ryder Cup that just are on a different level. There's just no way around it. And I don't discount that the tour or tours trying to push other events as just as significant as these majors almost turns people off a little bit and makes them almost resist that. Some, I don't know. It's a hard thing to gauge, but I do sense that sometimes.
Yeah. I think it's just sometimes letting something have its own feel, its organic feel is the best case, you know. Best thing you can do but it's also the hardest thing, is like sitting aside and saying, like, hey, if we do nothing, it's the best thing we could do, is like something that's very hard to come to grips with.
Right. And you have a lot of people who are making decisions who've worked in marketing, and marketing people, that's their training, is to push and get the word out. And if they don't do that and the thing isn't talked about and there aren't impressions and views, and then they get in trouble. So it's a tricky balance.
That'll do it for part one with Jeff Shackelford. We'll be back later this week with part two of our conversation with Jeff. Thanks, and hope you guys have a great week.
You've been listening to the Fried Egg Podcast. We do the digging for you.